Now, tomorrow, the Dublin Book Festival is delighted to have the pleasure of hosting an inspirational evening with Mary McAleese. It's at 7 o'clock during the special In Conversation event. Mary McAleese will talk about her new memoir, Here's the Story, and offer invaluable and inspirational insights from her many years of public service. That's tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock, and this is Mary McAleese on the line. Good afternoon.
How are you, Ray? How are you doing?
Good. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you. It was good to get it done, yeah. Finally.
I'm interested to know why you chose the picture on the back.
I didn't choose it.
Oh, you didn't choose it?
No. I mean, it's one of a... It's actually a picture of me as a child in Butlins years ago. And I gave the Penguin, who are the publishers of the book, a whole bunch of photographs to choose from for the cover, and they chose that one. So, and in fact, it's going to be the cover. That particular picture is now going to be the cover of the paperback version, apparently. So there you are.
So why do you think they chose that?
They thought it was sweet. I think they thought it was sweet.
Yeah.
It's cute.
Yes.
I think. I don't know. Yeah. I have no idea what judgment. These are the people who know what appeals, you know, and what catches the eye, I suppose. But anyway, there you are. That's the one they've chosen. It's on the back of the book.
Yeah. There's a sort of an innocence about it. There's a neutrality about it.
I guess that's right. Yeah, yeah. There is. Yeah.
I have so many questions to ask you. I don't know where to start. I understand you a lot more and your personality because I've been in your company once, maybe twice. And you have this ease with people. And I was always wondering, where did she get that now? And it's because you were a bar woman, girl, maid.
I was raised in two places where the public matter. My mum's sisters, and indeed my mum and my brother, were all hairdressers. So when I was growing up, I was, you know, in the hairdressing salon, which is a great place for gossip and chat and talking to people. And, you know, I'd be the one who'd be washing the hairs or sweeping the floor. But the other place that I was in my father's pub, you know, where you were serving and chatting and cleaning. And so, yes, they're very convivial, sociable places where if you need to have a bit of an odd personality to survive them, I think.
Yeah. And that's shone through in all your public life, that personality. And indeed, it shines through in the book as well.
And I think you have to like people. You have to be really interested and curious about people to make the best of it. So it's not a chore. I always loved being in the salon. I just loved the salon. Mm. And I loved the bar. And there were two different environments because, you know, one was all women and the other was all men.
Yeah.
Completely different environments. But I loved them.
So your dad ran the Long Bar in
Belfast?
He
did, yeah.
Yes.
He did.
Okay.
Yeah.
In there, what was it, a nationalist bar or was it a...
Well, it was in a nationalist area. It was in the Falls Road.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. And it was called a Long Bar because it spanned two streets. The front door was in one street and the back door was on another street. And there were days, particularly on big race days, where if you opened the front door, people would have fallen out the back door because it was so packed.
Right,
it was so jammed. I remember one famous day that it must have been some big race meeting on, and it was a bookies next door, of course. And my father was to the pin of his collar to squeeze more people in. It wouldn't do now with COVID, but he, at one point, one of our, a very famous barman in our place was a guy called Pat McAllister, who, an old socialist who'd fought against Franco in Spain. And Pat stopped everything. He said, "Everybody just stop right now. I've had an idea," he said, "how we can create more space." And everybody stopped and he said, "We'll scrape the bloody wallpaper off the wall." So that's how bad it was.
And you were very friendly with Pat, and as people won't know this, but as a result of him and his, well, I suppose your chats, you became an atheist at one stage.
For a short time, yeah. Well, yes. Actually, for quite a time, actually, at school. Yes, I did. And applied to join the Communist Party of Great Britain and Ireland, actually. Yeah, under his tutelage, he was bitterly anti-clerical.
Right.
And virulently anti-clerical and anti-church. And you can kind of understand in a way, he was a very bright man and with a gorgeous, delightful, soft, gentle face. But he had his very strong political views. He had gone to Canada as a young fella and had joined the International Brigade, had gone to fight against Franco. And then when he came back to Ireland, because of his politics and because of the role the church played, you know, in appointments and in jobs, he found it very hard to get a job. And because of people's attitudes to people like him, you know, who had fought against Franco, he found it hard to get a job. So my father gave him a job.
Right.
And then he was a single man. He lived alone. Great raconteur. He introduced me to Spanish. Actually, never mind atheism, really, because that was a temporary phenomenon. My mother saw to that, and the headmistress saw to that. But he introduced me to Spanish.
Right.
And his Spanish was diabolical. Now, probably mightn't be that much better, you know, spoken with a broad Belfast accent. But he had a great love of the poet Lorca, Federico García Lorca. And that's, I developed a great love of Lorca's poetry thanks to him.
Uh-huh. I'm going to come back to Pat McAllister later on in our conversation because you described him as a very bright man and an atheist. So that's
right.
I'm going to come back to that later on. So the Long Bar ended up being bombed, and another bar that your dad was involved in was bombed as well by two different sets of paramilitaries.
Yes, they were very ecumenical in that regard. Unfortunately, the Long Bar, it was particularly tragic because loyalist paramilitaries left a car bomb outside of it, which exploded and killed a young woman, right, a mother of two young children, whose brother was a good friend of mine. And my father ran to grab her. He saw her falling. And what happened was the keys of the car, it seems, when the car exploded, they broke her neck. And so she didn't have any serious looking injuries. And my father thought that she had just fainted. And he grabbed her and was trying to revive her when the ambulance and the police, and indeed RTE cameramen who were first on the job, arrived. And it was an RTE cameraman who told me that he was the person who had to tell my father that she was dead.
Right.
And like, my father went out to work that morning, you know, his usual bright, cheerful self. And he came home a different person. That's the effect of trauma, I suppose. The second bar was bombed by that was loyalists did the first bar. The second bar was by the IRA. I have no idea why they did that either. But there was thankfully there was no life lost and there were no injuries. Thank goodness.
Yeah, but your family, like there was an occasion where the UDA machine gunned your house. Luckily, there was nobody in it. Your brother John was nearly murdered by a group of loyalist thugs.
They attempted to kill him, yes.
Yes, you were in the thick of it up there.
And John, of course, is profoundly deaf.
Yes.
So, you know, he was, I suppose you'd use the expression, you know, he was an easy target. And the awful thing about that was before they tried to kill him, they mocked him, the fact that he was deaf. Now, we didn't see any of this, though it happened outside our door. We were at home. He was at the deaf club that night and the bus stop was right across the street from the road. We lived on a main road and the bus stop was across the road and he got off the bus. These boys were on the bus with him, behind him. They had been stalking him. And they attacked him, stabbed him. And an elderly gentleman saw that and he came to our door desperately, you know, obviously desperately upset. And we were at home and my mum and I and the other kids and listening or watching TV when we heard screams. And because we'd never heard John scream before, you know, and because he's profoundly deaf from birth, he has a different timbre to his voice from, you know, from people who are used to speech. And it took us a second or two before we realised with horror that it was John. I thought at first it was a bunch of kids because it was a youth club not far away. And I thought there were a bunch of kids kind of acting the idiot. And then we realised, no, it was John. But I often thought, you know, quite apart from the fact that they set out to, you know, to do him serious violence. And because he was a Catholic and because he was deaf, the fact that they mocked him because he was disabled,
yes,
you know, because he had that deaf disability, it just says so much about the kind of people, you know, who were involved in paramilitarism those times.
Yeah, you said of them, there's some great put-downs in the book. I didn't expect them.
You didn't, no.
Well, you said paramilitarism did not generally attract the best brains.
No, and I think that is true.
Yeah.
I think that is true. Now, at the same time, I would also accept that in the maelstrom of, you know, the sectarian conflict, things happened that made young men in particular,
yes,
make decisions, instantaneous decisions that they may have regretted later, but that they couldn't escape from.
Yeah.
You know, there were paramilitary organizations just waiting for the angry young men to be, and then they recruited them. And once you were in, you were in.
And of course, there was a lot of reasons to be angry.
And there were a lot of reasons.
And
to
we didn't understand that down in the South. Well, most of us didn't.
No, that's correct.
And
that Who could? It was so dysfunctional, Ray. It was so utterly, abysmally dysfunctional. When you live in a reasonably civilized society, it's kind of hard to understand the level of dysfunction in an unreasonable society, even if it is next door.
Yeah, it was only up the road. That's the thing.
You were
shocked when you came down here and you realised that we didn't understand what was going on, like 100
miles
up the road.
And not so much even shocked that people didn't understand it, but that there was a fair level of disinterest also.
Hmm. You're highly critical of some people within this organisation, which is there in the book.
Well, I worked in it, and I have to say that I hope that I complimented those who I thought did a great job.
You did,
But those that didn't do a good job through times that when a good job was needed, I was pretty tough on because I think they deserved it, frankly. But anyway, I'm not the first to say it. I mean, it's been well documented over many years now.
You're the eldest of nine. And I'm third in a family of nine. I can spot my elder brother's personality traits in you.
What are those?
Yes, exactly. We used to call him the foreman. He never did much, but he told us to do everything. No, that's not fair on you. It's fair on him,
I was not a delegate. I mean, I can delegate, but in those days, I was definitely mommy's little helper. You know, when my mother says that she reared nine children, I usually tap her on the shoulder and say, "Don't forget, I reared five of them for you."
Mm.
Because you had to then those times, you know, you had to pitch in and help. And my mother and her siblings between, she's one of 11, and she and her siblings between them have 60 children, 6-0. So and we all kind of lived, you know, reasonably close to each other. Martin would tell you when I first got married, I couldn't make tea for two people. I couldn't make dinner for two people. I could make it for 22, but no way could I make for two people, with the result that in our first year of marriage, he put on about 3 stone. And then he decided the only thing for it was to buy me a freezer. And that was the upbringing. That was the formation, that there was always a crowd and you were always providing for a crowd. And you had to be handy. You had to be a worker.
Yeah. What's the name of that malt bread? It begins with a V. It's mentioned in the book.
Vita. Oh, you had to mention it. That's the thing. It's just breaking my heart at the moment.
Is that similar to Maltana we used to have? That's a Mary McAleese put down there.
I can't mind. I don't mind Maltana. Don't get me wrong. I love it toasted, but you'll never beat a Vita. A Vita loaf is peculiar to Northern Ireland, and it is truly it's a very special taste. It's one of our great treats. You know, when we go up north, is to buy the Vita loaf and bring it home. And my family, when they come here, they'll always bring a Vita loaf. And friends from the north, when we were in the Arras, they would be bringing Vita loaves. But unfortunately, COVID has killed off the Vita supply chain.
Okay, and Vita's a brand name, is it, Mary?
It is. I guess it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Martin. So in the book, and it's an interesting sort of study of two lives. You know, how Martin turned out, him married to a president of Ireland and a very successful man and did huge work in diplomacy. And then Bobby Sands and, you know, two people with similar enough backgrounds. And how do they end up in such, you know, opposite lives?
Well, that's why I think, you know, there but for the grace of God go any of us, and why I would have whenever we started to outreach to the loyalist paramilitaries, even though they had, you know, they'd cost us our home and our sanity at times, I felt an understanding and not quite an empathy, I suppose you wouldn't call it, but a sympathy for all these young people who had been brought up with a very strong formation and a very strong advocacy around them, a strong culture that was constantly pulling them into violence and telling them it was righteous and telling them they were heroic. And that was very hard to resist, particularly when I knew some of them. I mean, some of my neighbours joined loyalists, my friends joined loyalist paramilitaries, and some of my friends joined the IRA. So I could see how it was that we lived inside a culture that it was hard to transcend that. Mm. And I always regard Martin and I as particularly lucky that we did. I think home has something to do with it, maybe, or luck.
Education.
Education to opportunity that we had. We had opportunities, you know, to go on to college and to become professional people. And our parents, in our house, we didn't hear the kind of language of sectarianism. We didn't hear the language of resentment, even though it was, a standard Irish nationalist household. On the other hand, my father employed Protestants, and he employed obviously atheists and anti-Catholics.
Pat McAllister, there he's mentioned again.
It wasn't a house that where we were formed in deep and toxic sectarianism. Mm. So I think that has something to do with it, maybe.
You mentioned just there briefly about Martin and when you invited the loyalists down to the Oris, and that was done under the radar completely, but it's detailed in the book here.
These
were loyalist paramilitaries. There were people from what I suppose not the wrong side of the tracks is the wrong word, but there were definitely people who would never have been invited to Oris Nuachtarán before
they would have sneered at
yes,
it.
Yeah.
There had to be quite an amount of work in preparing the ground for making them feel that the invitation wasn't some kind of a Trojan horse, that we weren't trying to proselytize or evangelize or turn them into Irish nationalists or Catholics, that we were about the business of doing a simple thing. Trying to build a culture of good neighbourliness where none had existed or where it had been damaged to the point that it was fractured. So we were about the business of trying to build good neighbours so that we could, so that if a time came, you know, when we could talk about hard stuff, before you'd ever get to the hard stuff, because talking about hard stuff in Northern Ireland, talking about politics or religion, can so often lead to a rawness of language and breakdown, or it could then, things have changed a bit. And so we wanted to be able to just meet, have a cup of tea, talk about kids, holidays, anything, and prepare the ground for the day coming when we would talk about tougher stuff and we would do it respectfully and could do it. Why? Because we were friends and now trusted each other across all those generations when there was no trust.
Yes. And Martin went up and he pressed the flesh and he met people in circumstances and areas that, you know, an Irish Catholic man probably hadn't been seen in a long time.
Martin grew up in a loyalist area though, Ray. And unlike me, I grew up in a Protestant area in Belfast. I had only Protestant friends in the street that I grew up in. My friends were Protestants because that's all there were in the street. My school friends, obviously, who were Catholics, I went to a Catholic school, but my friends in the street were all Protestant. Mm. Martin also grew up in a Protestant area, but he grew up in a loyalist area, very staunch loyalist area. And he didn't have Protestant friends. And whereas my mother could say to me, go round the corner and buy a pot of jam, and I would skip round the corner and get the pot of jam, never thinking of any problems. Whereas he, if he was asked to do that, and he's often described being asked to do that, he would be terrified. Why? Because in that short journey of a couple of hundred yards round the corner, he could be beaten, witless.
Yeah.
That was the kind. He lived in a much more embittered and sectarian place than I happened to. Now, the place that I inhabited eventually, you know, did descend into naked sectarianism, yes. But growing up there, there was a chance for it, but the chance was blown, essentially, unfortunately.
When you got elected President of Ireland, Uachtarán na hÉireann, was your goal to stay on for two terms of office, firstly, and secondly, to initiate the first visit by a queen or a king of England to Ireland?
Well, the idea for the Queen's visit was in my head from day one.
Was it?
Oh, it was, because I had talked to Her Majesty the Queen about that very thing before I ever became president, before I ever thought of becoming president back in 1995. I had met her and had lunch with her and had talked to her about this very thing. Not specifically, it had come up in a conversation when she told me that one of the greatest regrets of her life was that she had been unable to visit the Republic of Ireland, had never stood in it. She mentioned that she had 25 horses, I think, that had been trained in Ireland, and she'd never seen any of them run here. But then she said more seriously that it was that she'd never had the opportunity to visit. And so that was 2 years before I even before I became president, and I had no notion at that time that I could become president. So I had said to her at that time that, you know, that as the peace process was evolving, and I was very much involved in background work in the peace process, and also, of course, I was involved on behalf of the two churches, the two sects of churches, the Protestant and Catholic churches, in pushing a document that I and another and a group of us had at the instance of the churches. We had come up with a document on sectarianism, a plan for how the churches could help redeem the sectarian toxic atmosphere. So I'd been involved in all that, and I said to Reno that I hoped that the work that we were doing and that everybody was doing, governments were doing, both the American government, Irish government, British government, the European Union, that all, and then of course all the participants in the North and the South, that would eventually conduce to a time when she could become a welcome visitor. So it was in my mind. Did I think I'd stay two terms? It, you know, going in on term one, it never occurred to me. No, is the answer to that. But as time went on, I felt that we still had a lot of work to do at the end of the first term. Yeah. Yes.
And in the book, I get the feeling that you saw the presidency as a way of achieving things that you wanted to achieve across the island of Ireland.
Absolutely.
And the Queen's visit was one of them. And you knew that the Garden of Remembrance was an important thing, that Croke Park was an important thing.
Yes.
And that her speaking Irish would be the cherry on the cake, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a lot of detail in the book about it, and it's really entertaining, and it's insightful and all that sort of thing. But just to get to the... So how did it happen in the end that she said... And you didn't know she was going to say it, did you? And that's why you reacted, like, with that wow.
No, because they played me. I mean, I had been told... I had suggested that she would use a couple of Irish words.
Five Irish words. What was it? Uachtaráin agus a Chairde, is it?
Uachtaráin agus a Chairde. And I suggested that those words, that small and simple though they were, that they'd be the first words we would hear her say. And they were the first words we heard her say. And I felt that they would have huge healing capacity. And I tried to explain that when we had meetings, prior to preparatory and planning meetings. But I was told emphatically that this was unlikely because it would be the first words, and because Irish and the relationship with Britain was so, had been so bad in the past, in the Irish language, that if she got anything wrong, if it all went wrong, then it would be terrible. And I understood that. And I said, I'm not going to push it. But then she sent me an emissary, Sir Edward Young, her personal private secretary. I explained to him that I thought these five words were important. I, on the same occasion, I also explained that I thought that she should, that I asked, would she consider going to Croke Park? And I explained why. And he came back to me and he said, yeah, Croke Park would be, she'd love to go to Croke Park. She understood the significance of it, obviously. And she's very well read on Ireland. And but he said, look, the Irish language thing is just, we're just terrified that if she got it wrong, it would seem like an insult. And I immediately said to him, forget it.
Right.
I'm not going to push it. It was only an idea. I don't want her to take any point. I'm not taking any point here. I'm accepting absolutely the bona fides. We'll leave it at that. But then... as happens, every day of the week in any house in Ireland, the High Commissioner of Islamabad, British High Commissioner, landed to our house on his way from Islamabad to London.
Right.
And he said to me, Edward Young's a friend of mine. He said that you had five words in the Irish language. And I said to him, don't you be raising that now. He's an old friend of mine. I said, don't you be raising that now, because this subject's closed. Ah, he said, Edward just wants the five words written out, he said, so that he'll have it for the record. So he took a scrappy envelope, I kid you not, from his pocket, which he still has, incidentally, now in Perth. And he gave it to me, and I wrote the five words out. I wrote the Ronogs Akarju.
Phonetically, I hope.
I wrote them out phonetically.
Yes.
And he stuck it in his pocket, and that was the last I heard of that.
Until the night.
I was sitting there on the night, and when she got up, and I still can't believe how they played me, because my own staff was in on it, and they were all sitting waiting for the moment whenever she spoke Irish, and I would have a heart attack. Yeah. Because, in fact, earlier that day, I had given her as a gift a little replica of a book that was prepared for Queen Elizabeth I when she met Gran Abhail.
Right.
It was a little primer in Irish. And that was the gift that we had given her. So when she sat down, I said to her, you were a quick learner.
Very good.
And she was really delighted that she'd been able to play a bit of divilment, but also two good parts. She's put a lot of effort into getting the pronunciation absolutely right. She put a lot of effort into making the decision to use the language, as she did the same with Croke Park, you know, with going to Croke Park. She knew exactly how those things would matter, how deep they would go.
Religion obviously is throughout the book. How do you describe it? You're a religious person. I have to ask you a few questions because every time I read about you, I'm confused. You're confusing when it comes to religion, because at every turn in the book, religion slaps you in the face. There's so many things that have happened. Like two of your brothers, one of them was physically and psychologically abused by a cleric. Another one, John, was sexually abused by a cleric. There are so many things in the book that paint the Catholic Church in such a very, very poor light. And yet you continue to be loyal to that church. I don't understand, Mary.
Neither do I.
Try and explain to me?
Yeah, I will, because, first of all, there is this thing called faith that I have. I have a faith. Mm. And I've often said to my children that faith will be very lucky if it survives religion, because religions have managed to put us all in bunkers that, you know, that have made a nonsense of faith in God at times. But I stay with the church because it is 1.2 billion people worldwide. Its management system is atrocious, absolutely atrocious. This week of all weeks, we've just had the McCarrick report.
Yes. Yeah.
And we've also had from England, we've had the Independent Inquiry into Clerical Catholic Abuse, Clerical Child Abuse in England report, and Wales. And both of them tell a story of a management structure that is beyond acceptable. It veers from outright stupidity and carelessness all the way through to corruption. And so that's at the management level. The structure is appalling. It's old. It's based on old vanities of empire and clericalism and maleness and sexism. And so that structure is no longer fit for purpose. But the church, as the people of God, 1.2 billion people, Ray, it's the biggest NGO in the world, the biggest NGO, bar none, in the world. It runs 200,000 schools. It looks after the sick in the developing world. It looks after the poor. And I understand that down that conduit that good comes, there's also bad that comes with that. I mean, there's the nonsense of some of the doctrine of the church that is sexist, that is homophobic. And I want to stay in the church and with the church for as long as I have a voice to see if that little voice, along with other voices, can help change the narrative, change the management structure, which I say is just atrocious, and also ask very, very, I think, really very profound questions that are not being asked at the moment. The most important for me at the moment is that the church teaches that the day I'm baptized as a baby, and most of us are baptized as babies, that I actually on that day became a lifelong member of a church, and that I took on obligations, and one of those obligations is to be obedient to the magisterium.
But now, Mary, you'd no choice. You'd no choice. The same as I'd no choice. I had no choice to be baptized into
correct.
The Catholic Church.
And you're absolutely right. Yeah, that's the point I'm making, that you cannot, with our understanding today.
No, but surely I must have choice then to leave it and to.
That's a different. We actually. Yeah. The Church doesn't give you a chance to leave. There is no such thing as leaving the Catholic Church,
But isn't that bonkers? Isn't that bonkers in itself?
Exactly what I'm saying. That's what I've written on. That's what my last book, not this one, but my last book was exactly about. We live in a world now where human rights teach us. We have our freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, freedom of opinion, freedom to change religion. The church has not engaged with that yet, but it needs to. I mean, the first book written on this subject was mine when it was published last year.
Okay.
They do not engage with our human rights.
Here's a bigger philosophical question. You know, whenever I talk about religion, people say, well, what would happen if there's no religion? Sure, you know, we descend into barbarism or whatever. But I believe that we are born with an innate decency and a moral code. As humans, we're born with that. And then when people surrender their moral compass and create some sort of allegiance to a deity, that's when the problems start. And the first 15 minutes of our conversation outlined that, sectarianism.
I wouldn't disagree with you. Would not disagree with you. I think religion has a lot to answer for in terms of how it has cultivated contempt for the other in the world rather than a sense yes. of unified family under God. And it has to answer for that. But the truth of the matter is, 5 out of 7 people in the world today identify with one of the major world religions. It is still religion is still a phenomenally strong impulse, phenomenally strong influence.
We're going back to Pat McAllister now. Very yep. bright man. You're a very bright woman. Do you think that the Catholic Church, as it is structured, is beyond salvation? Like, you have tried, you've been knocking at the door, you've been shouting. The empire of misogyny. Like, what do you think?
Well, here's the thing. I believe in the power of change and the power of people to change. If I didn't believe in that, I wouldn't have gone into the Aras to try and do the work that we did to build the bridges. And I've lived long enough to see that there is the possibility for change. There's always resistance to change. I mean, we've seen that, the pushback. But I think you're right that there is an innate decency. There's a goodness in people. I think the great thing about the human person is the capacity to love and to give love and to be loved and to accept love. And that is transformative. That transforms a lot of things. And for as long as religion tries to, if you like, knock that out of us or turn love into something that actually becomes a way of being contemptuous of other people's religion, then it has to answer for that. I like to think, I lived in a community a few years ago in Rome with people who were Muslim, people who were Eastern Orthodox, people who were Jewish. And among the things that just used to bemuse me, because one of my great, great close friends is a Muslim woman. She and I, when we talk about prayer, when we talk about God, we light a candle. Our faith could just be, if we were to distill it into 2 or 3 lines, it's exactly the same. Very little difference.
Yeah, like, but
how we express that.
Yeah, but look at how religion has wrecked the world. And the pastoral aspect of religion which is obviously real and has been real for years and years and years, this is impossible to prove, but that would have existed anyway, because we are decent, innately decent. We are nice to each other because we're social animals. Like, no other animals descend into barbarianism, because they're social units and we are social animals. Anyway,
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you. And I do think that religion has a lot to answer for in that regard. And religion and people who are religious have to ask themselves that question. Is their religion getting between them and loving the otherness of others? Or is it actually promoting contempt? If it's contempt, then there's something wrong.
So you're there for the long haul anyway.
For the time being.
I suppose facetiously people have said to you in the past, why don't you go off and form your own religion? And I'm sure that's been said to you.
I'm exercising my human right to do what I want to do.
Okay. Well, listen, the book comes highly recommended from here. I think it should be on the curriculum for secondary school because I think studying history, in the general, probably is uninteresting for a lot of people, but studying it through the eyes of you who've gone through so much and been at the centre of the whole thing for so many years is probably a better way of doing it. And I've really enjoyed our chat.
I think you're right. I always love talking to you, Ray. Thanks a million.
Thanks so much for taking time out.
Not at all. Absolute pleasure.
Mind yourself.
See you in Carrick and Shannon
Yes. We never got to talk about that, our little meeting in the cafe. Good luck, Mary. See you. Say hello to Martin first.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.